Your Honor, may it please the court. The issue before the court today is the viability of one of the plaintiff's two causes of action. In addition to their claims for unfair debt collection practices, which remain pending in the trial court and are not before the court today, the plaintiffs have tried to squeeze their way into a Chapter 12 claim as well for fraudulent lien. But Chapter 12 is a narrow statutory cause of action that simply does not fit the facts that the plaintiffs have alleged. If the liens here comply with Property Code Chapter 55, and they do, then they cannot support a Chapter 12 claim. We put in our in the bench book at tab one of the exemplars of the hospital liens at issue, which I'll be looking at regularly during this argument. This lien notice has basically two pieces of information that are important.
Can I ask
today.
A quick question? Yes. Just for a housekeeping matter, Mr. Phillips? When the lien is filed like this, and I tried to ascertain this from the briefs and was unable to, is the actual medical bill then attached to the lien as supporting evidence,
it
or
is not.
It just this document?
Just this document.
Okay.
The bills are not filed.
All right. Thank you.
So this notes that there is a lien and that it's for the reasonable value of the claimant's services.
But it never states forth what the amount of the lien is.
It does not. The plaintiffs have asserted three reasons that the liens here violate Chapter 55. The first is that they claim that the lien is for more than the amount allowed by Chapter 55. The second is that they claim that Chapter 55 requires an inpatient admission to the hospital, which did not happen here.
So let's talk about, Mr. Phillips, that first requirement,
certainly.
The first argument that they're making, that it is above the amount required. My question is, if we are then to apply Chapter 12 of the Texas Civil Remedies Code, how are we to ascertain whether that requirement is met if we don't have a specific amount?
Well, I think that is the point of this case. Because we track the exact language of the statute, Chapter 55, and again, there's a dispute among the parties about if there's a limit under Chapter 55. Reasonable and regular rate is what the plaintiffs say. We disagree with that, but we've conceded that for purposes solely of this argument.
But isn't that what the statute says?
It does. It talks about reasonable and regular rate, and we're not here to fight about that today. But I think there's some arguments about whether that applies to these charges.
Well, it's just because you said it tracked the statute. And
yes.
It doesn't exactly track the statute, does
it? It's exactly the same language that the Supreme Court has used in the North Cyprus case. So the statute says reasonable and regular rate. This says reasonable value. We cited the court in the North Cyprus case from the Texas Supreme Court where they repeatedly use those two terms interchangeably. There's no material difference between reasonable and regular and reasonable value. So our point, and I think that our argument here is, this lien notice, you can know it complies with the statute because it tracks the statutory language.
It does, but one of the reasons that we're here is the denial of the plea as to whether the monetary value. I mean, you won on summary judgment on two of the grounds, but not the third ground,
correct,
which is, I think, the reasonable rate. And so is the tracking of the language sufficient, or does it create, as we're already having a discussion this morning, that factual issue that the trial court found in the underlying case?
I think it is sufficient, and the reason it's sufficient, again, goes back to the fact that a Chapter 12 claim is a very limited claim. The lien itself has to be invalid. It has to be not compliant with the statutory terms. Here, because we say the lien is for a reasonable value, we've tracked the statutory terms. If they want to complain about how the lien gets used, that's their debt collection claim, and that's what's still pending in the trial court. But the question is, can they fit into this very narrow statute that requires that you knowingly use or present a false lien? And there is a lien here. And we said it's for the reasonable value. And the fact that the plaintiffs disagree about what reasonable value is doesn't mean it's not a Chapter 12, a proper lien for purposes of Chapter 55, and so it can't support a Chapter 12 claim.
But in the end, because I know there's some talk about there's an account number on here that probably references the account number to the medical bills associated with this lien. Would that be correct?
I am not certain. The record isn't clear on that. It is an account number at the bottom.
So then the hospital would have an account where there is an amount of money that is owed. Once these are attempt to be settled, I guess in the real world, there's always negotiations. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, so if the bill said $20,000, that's maybe not the regular and reasonable rate? Or why would it say 20,000 and then ultimately get settled for 10,000?
I think there are a number of reasons that it might get settled for less than the billed amount. But the point here is, by putting the account number, they're not saying that the billed amount is the reasonable value. They're still saying just the reasonable value. And again, we're back to the Chapter 12 cause of action, right? If they have a complaint about how it was used or whether there's a dispute about reasonable value, that's the debt collection claim, not the statutory Chapter 12 claim. As we put in our briefing, it's unclear if saying this, if putting the statutory language essentially in the notice, is not sufficient to make it compliant with Chapter 55 for purposes of whether it's about a fraudulent lien under Chapter 12, it's unclear how any hospital would ever be able to file one of these notices.
Can I ask you, as a practical matter, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but do you know why, as a practical matter, the hospital just doesn't attach the account? Is it because they think the amount's unreasonable, or because they know they're going to have to negotiate?
I do not know why. There may also be HIPAA issues there, too, because if you attach that and file it in public records, you're putting in all kinds of details about the treatment. So I don't know why it's not attached. And I think, too, I'd come back then to the case that we've cited to the...
But just following up on Norma, you don't have to apply the state, but could you put an amount in the lien? I mean, I know that in other liens, like a mechanics lien, the amount is actually placed. We seem to be having the issue of just vaguely putting a lien without saying what that lien amount is.
So a mechanics and materialman's lien is for the specific amount that is owed. And so, yeah, frequently they list that amount. Here again, because the lien is for the reasonable value or reasonable and regular rate, to track the language, that would be the way to do it. Could someone decide to put the rate in certain, or what they think they're owed in there? Certainly. But I don't think that's a requirement in the statute. The statute doesn't say you have to say how much is owed. And again, if you're trying to make sure you're complying with Chapter 55, tracking the statutory language is the best and easiest way to do it. I point the court then to the Hooker, Wright versus Hooker case, which we say completely decides this issue, because it was another lien under Chapter 55. It was a lien for emergency medical services, ambulance services. And the lien there, just like ours, didn't have an amount in it. It just said, we have a lien for emergency medical services. And the Court of Appeals said, that is valid. That's not an invalid lien just because the underlying bill was for $1,200 and the lien is limited to $1,000. Because the lien notice itself didn't purport to say we're getting $1,200. It just said we have a lien. So there was nothing in the lien that said that they were seeking more than what is allowed, and therefore it was valid. So we have the same thing here. All we did was say we are entitled to the reasonable value of our services. And that's all that's required for Chapter 55. And if that's required for Chapter 55, then it cannot support a Chapter 12 claim.
And there's no dispute, is there, that all of these plaintiffs at some point or another were treated by the hospital because as a result of an accident caused by someone else?
There is no dispute about that fact, yes. That is correct, Your Honor. As I say, the only three things they've complained about are the things that are at issue here today. This thing, the admission issue, and the misnomer issue.
Before we run out of time, and I know we have a lot of issues, let's talk about the admission issue real quick, since it is as to whether the admission as required, and I see from your bench when we reviewed it this morning that you do have 55.0015.
Correct.
So do you believe that's all that's necessary, even though they are saying that it wasn't a true admission or service by the hospitals?
Well, I don't think they're disputing service. They're saying, and the way they're disputing admission is saying that admitted as used in the statute requires admitted as an inpatient. But we do think the easiest way for the court to answer that question is look at 55.0015, because the legislature clarified the statute to say it does not require inpatient admission. Receiving treatment in any department of the hospital qualifies as admission for 55.002. And
would
this
you
is
say
not
that's maybe an amendment rather than a clarification? I mean, it's kind of
right.
Because it would not apply to what's being asked for here, is it?
Well, the legislature in the bill, not in legislative history, but in the actual bill enacting the statute, there is a provision that says the purpose of this is to clarify, not to change the law.
Okay.
And so our argument is, yeah, it does apply. And it does apply because it's not a change in the law. And one thing that's really important to understand on that is there is not a court anywhere in the state of Texas that has ever agreed with the plaintiff's argument that admission or admitted, as used in Chapter 55, requires inpatient admission. They can't point you to any court that's ever decided that. And so there was no right to change. The legislature was simply clarifying the law to say this is what it has meant all along. So we think that that is by itself enough for the court to say that inpatient admission is not required. But even without it, the plain language of Chapter 55 doesn't require it. In order to get to the plaintiff's view of Chapter 55 and admitted, you have to add language to the statute. You have to say admitted as an inpatient instead of admitted. And we've cited to the court on pages 29 and 30, or 19 and 20 of our brief, and also in the amicus brief, a host of cases all over the state of Texas covering decades where courts have used the phrase admitted or admission to deal with treatment in an emergency room. That is the plain language of admitted to the hospital. It's not restricted to inpatient admission, as the plaintiffs would like this court to do. So there's no basis to argue, based on the plain language of the statute, that admitted has to be limited to inpatient admission. The only way the plaintiffs can get there is by a very complicated, convoluted, pulling little pieces of statutes and regulations from all over the code to try to cobble together an argument that admitted is limited to inpatient admission. And we've laid out in our brief why they're simply wrong about that. And I think the biggest thing to understand about that is their entire argument on that rests on a false premise. They've told the court that CMS regulations, and that's Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which we don't think even control here, but they've told the court that those say that if you have an outpatient treatment like in an emergency room, and you don't ultimately get admitted to the hospital doesn't get paid at all. Well, that's just wrong. That would mean that anybody who goes to the emergency room and doesn't ultimately get admitted, the hospital gets nothing from Medicare and Medicaid. But their entire argument rests on that idea that you have to have a successive inpatient admission after treatment in the emergency room to get paid. They're simply wrong about that. We've explained why they are in their brief. And once that argument is cut out from underneath, then their entire technical argument about the meaning of admitted falls away. And they're basically left with arguing that they just want it to mean that, but it simply does not. And they've also pointed to legislative history. They claim legislative history on that. But what they cite to is a bunch of failed bills and statutes or statements from individual legislators that the Texas Supreme Court has said we should not look at for legislative history. So we think the trial court exactly got it right on the question of whether an inpatient admission is required. It's simply not. And again, you can get there most easily with 55015. The legislature has said what it means, but even without it, the statute was clear that it is not required to be admitted as an inpatient.
I wanted you to go back. My understanding in reading the court's findings in the trial court, and the trial court in this case, in the order, talking about Wright versus Hooker.
Yes.
And how the trial court distinguished it in the Wright versus Hooker in his finding.
So the main thing he distinguished it on was the presence of this account number. And as amicus has pointed out, they went back and pulled the record from Wright versus Hooker. There's an account number on that lien as well. So that's not a distinguishing factor.
Was that before the trial court?
It was not. We hadn't pulled that. So
is that outside of the record for us to take into consideration the difference of the fact scenarios of the two cases?
I think you don't need...
Since it's not in the opinion.
I don't think you need to get there. I think it's helpful information from an amicus to say that this isn't really a distinguishing factor. But even if you don't get there, it doesn't distinguish it. The court said that somehow it was anchored, the trial court, that this putting this account number anchors the lien in the bill and that a reasonable fact finder could find that maybe they were trying to recover the amount in the bill. I submit, if you look at this lien notice, there's no reasonable fact finder could do that. There is nothing in here that allows this simple account number, the identification of the person by account number, to override the plain language of the lien notice, which says it's for the reasonable value. And for the purposes of Chapter 12, that's all we need, is to have it track the language of the statute. Again, as I say, the plaintiffs are trying to squeeze their way into a cause of action that these facts simply don't fit. If they have a dispute about the amount of a reasonable value, if they have a dispute about how the lien was used, that's something they can bring up in their debt collection practice claim, but it's not a Chapter 12 claim, which requires that the liens be actually invalid. And these liens exist, and they were valid, And for these reasons, we think the court should render judgment that they take nothing on their Chapter 12 claim.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Any further questions before Mr. Phillips sits? No. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's my pleasure to be here. It's wonderful to be back in the courthouse for a year and a half. It's just a great, great moment in time, and I'm honored to be here. And so, Your Honor, of course, there's three basic issues. I'm here today is whether or not there's an admission issue, whether or not the lien is facially valid or invalid, and then finally, whether or not the hospital statutorily complied with, statutorily complied with the requirements under the hospital lien statute on filing their lien and identifying the lien. So the first issue, Your Honor, here is the appellee, I guess, on the admission issue. I really think we need to talk about what a hospital is. And so because the statute and the Texas law identifies under 241 of the Texas Health and Safety Code, as well as 311 of the Texas Administrative Code, defines a hospital, a building with a bed, with a person that can stay in that bed for more than 24 hours. An emergency room is defined as emergency care less than 24 hours. A hospital is able to provide hospital care. An emergency room does not provide hospital care. They provide emergency medical care. If we look at the statute, the first paragraph, it says, I call it the Texas two-step. The two things that the plaintiff has to do is, number one, receive hospital care. Number two, be admitted in the hospital. If we look at the statute since 1933, 1953, and 1974, those three versions of statute specifically say the person has to be admitted, that the room rate cannot exceed a specific dollar amount, and the charges cannot exceed a reasonable regular rate. In 1981 is when they got away from the room rate limitation and specifically tagged the hospital charges to CMS guidelines.
But wouldn't that make no sense if we look at the overall statute of liens, because it allows for ambulances and for the EMTs and everybody to provide for liens, and the only one that would be isolated in this circumstances would be the emergency rooms, that if you take a step back is what the statute was enacted to protect, basically. It was enacted to protect the hospitals, right? I mean, I think we can all agree. And it's enacted to protect the hospitals. So why would it cover every other healthcare provider except for emergency rooms?
Well, I don't know. In 1933, 1954, and up until the early 70s, emergency rooms theoretically didn't exist. The advent of emergency rooms came about as a result of the Korean and Vietnam War. So emergency rooms did not exist. In fact, this court, in the court case called Jackson Hospital, specifically said, it's in the brief, specifically said that emergency room is not necessarily have to be part of a hospital. A hospital can be standalone without an emergency room. And in fact, the emergency rooms provide different kinds of care. It's called hospital care, hospital services versus emergency medical care, Your Honor. And so why hadn't they done it? Well, if you look at the statute, when they allowed for the EMS liens, they use the word receive. When they talk about the hospital, they use the word admit. Admit has a legal definition. If you look at the CMS guidelines, admit requires a doctor's order. We have all been in the emergency room with a child or a loved one, and been in the emergency room, and we always ask, are we going to be admitted in the hospital? Because that requires a serious medical condition that rises to the level to be admitted in the hospital, and it takes a doctor's order.
How do you reconcile that with 55.0015? Are you saying that because it says hospital, it doesn't apply to emergency rooms?
So 55 point, the new statute, Your Honor?
Yeah.
The new statute what they're using now is the word receive any care at the hospital from any department. They're using receive, Your Honor. And furthermore, Your Honor, that is specifically a change in the law versus the clarification. And if there's a change in the law, that makes it retroactive. And clearly, this is a targeted piece of legislation, because if you look at the sponsor of the bill, said, oh, we're doing this because there are lawsuits going on. But if you look at the findings in the bill analysis, they provide no findings whatsoever of any public interest necessary to protect. Just what happened on Crown Cork, Your Honors. There was no specific public protection other than a specific industry, a specific defendant.
But all all of that said, I mean, the plain language of it says any department within the hospital, a lien, or that's considered admitted into any department for services rendered. So
that is the new statute, Your Honor. That is what was enacted in 2019 in response to the lawsuits where hospitals were filing liens for people who only visited the emergency room and were never formally admitted into the hospital. That is the new statute in response to these lawsuits that the bill analysis says that is not designed to protect any public interest whatsoever other than a couple hospitals down in South Texas. They're filing these liens on people that visit the emergency room and don't get a doctor's order to be admitted in the hospital. That's what the response is, Your Honor. And so it's targeted legislation related to a lawsuit, and it's all designed to change the law. And in fact, in the briefing, Your Honor, there were several attempts to change the law. And in fact, the bill analysis, okay, I get that. They don't want to hear about a specific legislature talking up, but let's look at the bill analysis by the Senate and House Research Committees. And in those bill analysis, I guess it's SB 1031 in 1997, they specifically said, hospitals do not have a lien right until they're admitted in the hospital. So they've known about this from the beginning. But if we go back to the legislative history, and in 1981 they took the room rate out, and they specifically limited the hospital, because when you go to the emergency room you get a bill, and that bill, and by the way, Your Honors, if you go to the emergency room you have a different kinds of billing codes and you get admitted. There are different kinds of billing codes, because it's a different kind of visit.
But I want you to switch, Mr. Moore. Let's talk about whether this lien being what the appellant is calling facially valid is sufficient to give you a cause of action under Chapter 22 or Section 22.
It's all absolute nonsense, Your Honor, because what they've done, Your Honor, if you look at Texas Government Code 51.903, that law was enacted concurrently with Chapter 12. That was in response to this group of people calling them Republicans of Texas, and they were filing lawsuits and recording all these fake judgments and stuff. And that law says you can attack a lien for facial validity only. Okay, you look at the lien, and if the lien has something wrong with it, because you can't take any evidence in a 51.901 proceeding, it is completely as a matter of law. And that's what they're saying here. They've twisted this upside down. They're saying, hey, by the way, if we comply with Chapter 55, we comply, there's nothing you can do. Well, that just knocks out a whole body of law, Your Honors, because there's plenty of law involving liens where they're using the liens illegally, causing to them to extort money or doing something wrong or filing things wrong. But if you look at the document, it's been authorized by law. If it's authorized by law, then under their theory, you can't sue under that. But that happens all the time. There's cases, a case called Bernard in our brief, where somebody, a homeowner, filed their own trustee a sale.
You're telling the court that even if the lien is valid on its face, just assume for the sake of argument that it is for today's argument, that the hospital can be still sued as filing a fraudulent claim. But don't you have this whole knowledge that they know that this lien that they're filing is fraudulent? I mean, where does that knowledge come from then, I guess?
Well, that's the evidence in the case. That's the case you have. You make or present a document with and that's authorized by law, that's in the statute, but they're making a fraudulent lien or a fraudulent claim, the underlying debt. The law says you can't have a fraudulent debt and use that debt to collect. There's a case called...
But don't the plaintiffs, if they receive services, don't they owe the money?
Absolutely, but the
so
only...
Even if it's a fraudulent lien, does that extinguish the debt?
Well, I mean, we're not saying...
The way I look at it, it doesn't look like it extinguishes the debt.
We're not saying it extinguishes the debt, but you can't say... For example, in this case, Ms. Raquel Cerda, she went to the hospital. She had a hospital bill of $37,000 for about a three-hour stay. Her CT scans were $5,000 apiece. But if the reasonable regular rate for those CT scans are $1,200. But what they do is they use the lien to extort money from the plaintiff to pay that $5,000 bill, or else the plaintiff will never get their case settled. That's the unlawful use of a lien. It's a valid lien. The hospital lien is a valid lien, but the underlying debt they're using to collect with the lien is the fraud that's being committed. That's the extortion. That is the cause of action that we're talking about here. So you can have valid liens. Chapter 12 says you can have a valid lien, but just the, how you use the lien to cause financial injury is how this cause of action is specifically designed to handle, Your Honors. It doesn't matter.
So I fully understand about getting a $40,000 emergency room lien. All of us have been at the time where we open up a medical bill and go, oh my God, how did we get there, right? With that aside being said and the nature of that, the lien doesn't say $40,000. The lien doesn't say an amount. It just says reasonable. So that whatever the account says is irrelevant according to the appellant, because they're just going to try to recover what's the reasonable amount. And that's why their lien is valid.
That's okay. So, Your Honor, there's three basic elements needed for a hospital lien. It's the name of the plaintiff, the name of the hospital, and the date of the accident. That's the only three things you need to have on a lien. Now, this hospital says, well, it's reasonable value. And if you look at their opening brief, footnote 6, they talk about how they define reasonable value. What they do is they want to know the amount of the settlement. They want to know about the amount of the other doctor bills. They want to know the other costs in the case. And then they'll negotiate. That's their definition of reasonable value. That is not, if you look at Henry North Cypress of the Texas Supreme Court, they say the reasonable regular rate is what other payers pay. That is what the reasonable regular rate is.
So would that be a moving target from day to day, year to year, month to month?
Not necessarily, because you would take that number at the time of the provision of services, and then what you would do is to you get the reimbursement rates, Medicaid, Medicare rates, and cost rates for that specific category of care, and you find out what the average is of those cares to figure out what the reasonable regular rate, what other payers are paying, not what people are paying when you're forced with the lien hanging over your head, what you have to pay, because normally Blue Cross Blue Shield doesn't pay $5,000 for a CT scan. We know that for a fact. But when they use a lien to try to collect on it, that's the extortion. That is the financial injury, and it's right out of the statute, Chapter 12. You can have a valid lien, but you can't use an improper debt to go collect that debt with a valid lien.
Is a matter of which they're assessing their reasonable rate, as you've just described it, based on not what other people are charging or what medical or what the insurance is paying, but what the amount of the value of the case is. In other words, if there's more insurance companies, there's more injury, that affects the lien amount that they're able to recover?
That's exactly what they're saying in footnote 6. But really what they ought to be doing that analysis. You take what the other payers are paying, you get a number, and then you say, we're discounting from that number. We're reducing for not, versus well, you're going to pay $5,000 for a CT scan, and let's see how much money you're getting in costs and attorney's fees, and we'll figure out a number.
So, that's Mr. Moore, how do we resolve that issue in order for them to be able to file a proper claim that would not subject every lien then that they filed as a cause of action under Chapter 12?
Well, the filing of the lien is not the cause of action. It's what they do to collect the bill. That is the cause of action. That's what they're doing. They're causing financial injury. They're interfering with settlements. They're right in the middle of the settlement, and they're saying, what are you guys getting? Oh, by the way, we won a lot of it. In fact, in the Henry Serta case we cite, they ended up getting $19,000 when the reasonable regular rate was closer to $4,000. Okay, so they extorted an extra $11,000 or extra $15,000.
Yeah, and I fully understand that scenario, and I think that all of us in this room have been there before. But how do we fit that fact scenario as a cause of action under Chapter 12? When they go file that lien, how does that lien become fraudulent under 12?
The use of the lien, how they use it. So when the plaintiff lawyer calls the hospital and says, hey, my bill is $37,000, what's the reasonable regular rate? They should say, oh, it's $4,000. Okay, great. Can I get a discount from $4,000? Yes or no, whatever it is. But at that point in time, that's how you use it, versus it's $37,000 and you're never going to get your case settled unless you negotiate with us. And by the way, to negotiate with, you need to give us confidential settlement amounts. You need to give us your expenses, and then we'll figure out what the reasonable regular rate is. We'll make that on our own. I've got several cases in the MDL, Your Honors, where I cannot get the case settled because they're refusing to negotiate with me in good faith. They're demanding.
And they think we have a lien, so we don't have to negotiate with you.
I've had cases settled for 5 years that I can't get settled because they're refusing to negotiate based upon the reasonable regular rate. And we're able to get that fairly easy based upon the reimbursement rates from other payers that buy hospital services at arm's length transaction, where they negotiate a fair and reasonable number. When you get that number, then let's talk about getting the bills paid. Otherwise, we're being extorted, and it's causing financial injury. And that is how the cause of action in Chapter 12 occurs.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
I think what I need to refocus on is the record here. What is the record? Mr. Okay. Moore has talked to you about Ms. Serta and a whole bunch of wild allegations about reasonable and regular rate and what was done. You need to look very carefully at her affidavit. First of all, her affidavit doesn't actually say how they came to that settlement number. There's nothing in her affidavit that says that the hospital lien was even used to get to that settlement number. And when he argues to you that there's evidence in the record about the reasonable and regular rate for the services, we objected to that evidence. It's not properly before the court. It's from a website called Texas Price Point that just takes an average of every single service and figures out what they get paid on it. It's not proper evidence of reasonable and regular rate. That's not before the court today. And frankly, the court doesn't have to resolve any of that to get to this issue, because the main problem that the plaintiffs have at their Chapter 12 argument is, Mr. Moore, I think a couple of times said, you can take a valid lien and use it for invalid purposes and you have a Chapter 12 claim. They don't have a single case that says that, not one. All of the cases that they've cited to this court about Chapter 12 claims on liens or other claims, every single one of those, the underlying lien itself was invalid for some reason. Either they stated the amount too high, they actually stated the amount of the mechanics materialman's lien, and a jury found they knew that that was higher than what was owed, or they filed a mechanics materialman's lien without an underlying written contract, which is required for those kinds of liens. Every single one of his cases says that the lien itself was invalid. He can't cite you a single case that says you can take a valid lien, use it for bad purposes.
So here's my reverse to you, Mr. Phillips. There's no case either that says if you have a valid lien but use it for improper purposes, you can have a Chapter 12 cause of action. If you have a valid lien and you're using it improperly, let's just assume for that, you're filing it against the wrong person, you're trying to stop some invalid use, is there a case out there that says that's not the purpose of Chapter 12?
There is not a case that says it's not, but I think as they're the plaintiffs who want to bring a claim under Chapter 12, they've got to fit themselves within the statute, and there isn't one. And I think we need to be clear, too, filing it against the wrong person would be an invalid lien. And that, again, that's not what's going on here. There is a lien. It's for the reasonable value of the services. That's what we said. Everything else complies, and their complaint is you're using that improperly. That is a complaint they can make in their debt collection claim.
But isn't the issue really that the trial judge found that there was a fact issue as to whether or not it's reasonable?
Well, he found that fact issue based on a legal error about what's required for a Chapter 12 claim. That somehow you could find this fact issue about whether or not we were going to use it for an improper purpose. And then also I think he's just wrong about whether there's a fact issue.
Well, and I think he also said that in order for him to determine if there was a fact issue, that maybe at this stage additional discovery might be useful to see whether or not there were some sort of fraudulent practices going on. Do you have a disagreement with that?
I do, because I think you don't need to know that to know if you have a Chapter 12 claim. Because if the lien itself is valid, again, on it, we say facially, and he likes to take facially and bring this other statute into it. I don't literally mean if there's an underlying problem, you can't make a claim. What we mean is it is a valid lien. The only complaint they have about it is how it was used. The only complaint they make is that it was used, according to them, to get more than a reasonable value.
But following up on Justice Longoria's question, you know, we're here on a partial granting of summary judgment, denying of summary judgment, a traditional summary judgment, not a no evidence. So our standard of review is usually an abuse of discretion as to whether there was or was not an infraction, not a de novo review, which is almost what I believe your answer to Justice Longoria makes it sound like. We're reviewing it as a de novo review.
I think in deciding whether there's a fact issue, that is a de novo the court looks at it to decide whether there's a fact issue, and the court needs to look at what the underlying law is. And when the underlying law is that you can't have a claim under 12 for alleged improper use of a valid lien, then there can't be a fact issue here about Chapter 12. Again, if they want to bring that claim in their debt collection claim, have at it. But that's not the purpose of this particular statute. He also had this whole argument about ERs not existing in chapter in 1933. I want to respond on a couple of those things. Again, look at the plain language of the statute. If an ER didn't exist in 1933, then that supports us, because the whole point is to provide coverage for the entire hospital, not just for ERs. He also made an argument to the court, and I know my time's expired, about definition of a hospital, and cited to this court a bunch of statutes about what a hospital means. It's important to know, he didn't make any of those arguments below. He didn't make any of those arguments in his brief. That's the first time I've ever heard that argument. So you can't use that to reverse it, but even if he had, it's simply wrong, particularly in light of the new statute.
Do we have any further questions from Mr. Phillips on any issue before we ask him to sit?
No, we'd simply ask the court render judgment. They take nothing on their Chapter 12 claims and remand the case for further proceedings on their debt collection claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. What do we have, Mr. Moore?
Your Honor, the first I'd like to rebut, he says, I cannot show you all a case where there was a valid.
Oh, wait, the timer is not going off.
Oops.
Okay.
He challenged me saying, I can't show you a case. We didn't brief one case. Let's look at 409 Lone Star Property versus Bradford. That's an HOA case, Your Honors, where the HOA foreclosed on a piece of property and they overvalued the redemption amount. And so what happened is the owner of the house paid the redemption and then sued the homeowner association and said, you fraudulently used the amount in the redemption to violate Chapter 12. That's a valid lien. If you look at Wright versus Hooker, that's a valid lien. What they had is no evidence in the case that they improperly used the lien to collect more than what's allowed to the maximum the statutory maximum of $1,000. In the case called Vanderbilt Mortgage versus Flores, there was facially a valid lien. Who knew there was a bunch of fraudulent signatures on there? But it was a valid lien. What it did, it took evidence to show that it was not a valid lien. You want a case where there's no evidence? That's when you go back to 53.901, you get no. It's just facially valid lien or not valid. If you go to Centurion versus Seabrook, that's a case involving a person that's purporting to be an engineer, and he files an engineer lien. It facially, it looks like a valid lien, but it's not a valid lien. How? You take evidence in the case and you figure out, oh, by the way, you're not really an engineer. You're purporting to be an engineer, but you're not really an engineer. So, Your Honor, for those things, I need to open up on several issues here on the hospital not putting the right name on the lien. So again, the Chapter 55 requires you to have the name of the patient, the name of the facility, and the date of the accident. And in this situation, Your Honor, what happened is they put the wrong name on the lien for the hospital. It's called Rio Grande Regional Medical Center, and what they put on the lien was Rio Grande Medical Center. So they have the wrong name on the lien. And if you look at a case called Methodist Hospitals versus Mid-Century, that's the only reported case involving hospital liens and somebody messing up on the lien. In that situation, they put the wrong date of the accident, and they put the wrong name of the person who's at fault. And they said, that's enough, because you have strict compliance. Now, their cases they show are all these material men's liens. Because material men's liens have to be interpreted liberally, because we are dealing with laborers. The law says as long as there's compliance, there's substantial compliance, then they're going to get that laborer a lien. Otherwise, that would defeat the purpose. But you don't take that body of law and what we're talking about, the strict compliance, because there's only really three issues the hospital's got to get it done. And there's really no if, buts, and ors. They got to get and you would think they get their own name correct. But they got their own name wrong. And then you get the name of the patient and you get the date of the accident. That's all they have to do. I mean, if you look at mechanics and materials, there's a whole laundry list of stuff they've got to do. And they have to serve it to people and all kinds of stuff. But not with this, Your Honors. Because some case law on that is Train versus Woodthorne. It says mechanics and materials and liens are liberally construed for the purpose of protecting laborers and materials. We're not needing to protect a laborer or materials. I mean, we're dealing with the hospital. a multi-billion-dollar corporation. They can't even put the correct name on the lien. So, Your Honor, at least for the strict compliance for the lien, it should be kicked out on that issue. On the retroactivity, Your Honor, we need to look at Robinson versus Crown. That's a Texas Supreme Court case involving asbestos cases. Again, that legislation was passed with no public interest in the bill analysis. Same thing in this case. There's zero discussion in the bill analysis to any public interest. And they came back in the three elements there, because there was no factual finding of any public interest, that weighed heavily against Crown. It weighs very heavily against them. On the second factor is the nature of the prior right impaired by statute. Your Honors, this very issue was before you, and out of the MDL, there was a mandamus proceeding right after the statute HB 2929 was passed. Henry McAllen Hospitals mandamus to this court and said there was extraordinary circumstances that the Supreme Court identified in the case called Henry USAA, and because of that, because this involves thousands of cases, we want you to look at that, and you guys didn't. You passed on it. You said no. And then it went on to the Texas Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court didn't look at on a underlying summary judgment issue, which is basically what we're arguing about here today. So there is a nature of a prior right that could have been adjudicated, but it was not adjudicated. The plaintiffs in this case, as well as the hospital lien cases, because there's an MDL down in Brownsville against McAllen Medical Center for the same things that are going on. I see that I'm out of time.
Finish up.
So there is a vested right, and the extent of the impairment is designed targeted for litigation. We wouldn't be here today talking about the new statute about receive versus admission but for the fact this hospital, with several other hospitals, went to Texas legislature and got the legislature to pass a law designed specifically for this litigation. For those factors, Your Honor, we'd find that the law is improperly retroactive and violates our Bill of Rights in the Texas Constitution, and find that the hospital lien requires an admission to the hospital. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Moore? Yes. Thank you, Mr. Moore.